are cordially welcome. You may be seated. The students are here with a national award-winning program entitled Court with Class. Students across the state are invited to come to the court, listen to an oral argument, and then meet with a justice about the procedures of the court. The invitation is accepted. Material relating to the case is sent to the school, and here they are. And they will meet with a justice of the court after the this case is completed. Everyone is welcome to join the students with the justice, and the discussion will be the procedures, not the substantive issues of this case. So now that we've met you, let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks, and he is the justice with whom you will meet along with other students who were here at the prior argument, and it'll be right after this argument is completed. Seated next to Justice Crooks is Justice Patience Robinsack, and seated next to her is Justice Michael Gableman. Starting at the other end, the far right, is Justice Annette Siegler, and seated next to her is Justice David Prosser, and to my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. With those introductions made, I'll call the second case for today, Series 078B1160, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel versus the Department of Administration and others, the American Federation of State, Municipal, and County Employees, Council 24, Wisconsin State Employees Union, Intervenor Appellant. Before we start the argument, I should reveal to all the parties what they probably already know, but I will reveal it. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel has endorsed me for my recent very, very, very successful election, to which you congratulate me, I'm sure. And Patrick Marley has not. He's the other person as plaintiff. Nor has the Wisconsin Department of Administration. Now, AFSCME and the Wisconsin State Employees Union, at least AFSCME has endorsed me. I'm sorry, I can't remember if the State Employment Union has endorsed me, but related to these parties, but not parties, are the AFSCME people, which did make a PAC contribution, $8,625, which I think is the maximum allowed by a PAC, and the State Employees PAC called CPAC made a similar contribution. I intend to sit on this case, but if either of the parties have any objection, if you advise me, I will consider your objection. With that said, I will now call on Attorney Kurt Kobelt of Lawton and Cates, who represents AFSCME Council 24. Do you also represent the State Employees Union? Okay.
Good morning. My name is Kurt Kobelt. I represent the intervener appellant, American Federation of State, Municipal, and County Employees Council 24, the Wisconsin State Employees Union, in this case. The Court of Appeals certified a constitutional law question involving separation of powers issues regarding Article 244 of the labor agreement, whether it is a properly enacted statutory exception to the Open Rights Act. We urge this court to apply the Segal principle of avoiding constitutional questions unless absolutely necessary. There are at least two alternative grounds available to decide this case without addressing the constitutional issues. Either the statutory grounds found in Section 111.93.3 or through an application of the common law balancing test under the Open Records Act. Under Section 111.93.3, it does not matter if Article 244 is a valid exception to the Open Records Act. All that matters is that it is part of a collective bargaining agreement. If this court finds that Article 244 is related to conditions of employment, it must supersede the provisions of all other applicable statutes, including the Open Records Act. Section 111.93.3 explicitly excludes certain laws from its preemptive scope, and the Open Records Act is not among them. Further evidence that the legislature intended to permit collectively bargained exceptions to the Open Records Act is found in Section 111.91.2b, which lists no less than 22 statutes over which bargaining is not permitted. Again, the Open Records Act is not listed among these forbidden statutes. The only remaining question is whether Article 244 addresses a condition of employment. In the DER versus Building Trades Negotiating Committee case, the court broadly defined this term as including all matters which directly affect the interests of employees. The court cited with approval another case defining a condition of employment as including the quality and safety of the work environment. Now, it's undisputed on its record that the purpose of Article 244 is to protect the safety of the work environment of state employees, particularly employees working in correctional institutions, as parole agents, and as DNR wardens. These professional law enforcement employees have determined that their safety may be jeopardized by the publicizing of their names. It is undisputed, and the court found below, that the disclosure of names in today's computer age is tantamount to disclosing their home addresses and home telephone numbers.
Counselor, are there any state workers in correctional institutions who are not unionized, so who would not be covered by this contract?
There are non-represented employees who work for correctional institutions. Yes, the supervisory personnel.
Okay, so their names are simply available for disclosure, but you're just speaking to those folks who are covered by a union contract, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
How would the principles that you're talking about apply to local public employees?
Local public employees are covered by MIRA, a separate statute, and they have separate collective bargaining procedures, and they're really not affected by this case. They are not, the state employees union does not represent any local employees, so they're really not affected by this case at all.
Well, APSME would represent them.
There are two LASME entities in the state. One is Council 24, which is my client. They represent state employees. The other LASME entity is Council 40. They represent all of the various state, county, or not state, but the county, municipal employees. It's a separate entity.
So could they negotiate the same language with respect to local employees?
Well, they're governed by a separate collective bargaining statute, which is very similar to CELRA, the act at issue here. And I see nothing that would prevent them in MIRA to negotiate a similar kind of provision in a local kind of agreement. They may not have, the local employees would not have Section 111.93 available to them because that applies only to state negotiated contracts. But in all other respects, there's nothing in the laws that would prevent them from negotiating provisions addressing these same matters.
Doesn't the open record law apply to local people too? Local government entities?
Yes, it does, ma'am.
So how can a local legislative body that would endorse or accept local bargaining unit change the record, open record law? Isn't that one of the issues here, that the state legislature can change its law?
Well, if a provision similar to this were negotiated at a local level, then there is certainly a line of cases which address that and would state that a collectively bargained agreement that changes the law or that conflicts with the law supersedes and would prevail in those circumstances. But again, we're dealing with a unique entity here in the state employees having their collective bargaining agreement ratified by the legislature, as well as having the protections of Section 111.93.3.
Counsel, if someone from the public who wasn't a member of the press wanted this information and made an open records request, what would your response be?
Well, that would be, the union doesn't make that decision, Your Honor. It would be up to the relevant agency to whom the request was addressed to make that decision. And under the language of the current language of the agreement, the prior versions of the agreement were more broad. They applied to any entity and any person. Under that language, I think the answer would be no. Under the current language, only states the press and other unions. So that, under the current language, if someone is not the press or, I guess, what could be called a front person for the press or in some way put up by the press to do it, then that other person would have access without violating the collective bargaining agreement. However, that same person or that same entity, the agency handling such a request, would then have to apply the Open Records Act. And certainly, if you look at 1936-10A of the Open Records Act, that essentially duplicates the provision at issue here, with one exception, and that is the names.
Let me ask you this. This is simplifying it a great deal, I understand it. But part of your argument is this is cloaked with the protection because it went through the legislative process, and as a court, we should not interfere with that legislative process. Once the legislature goes through and accepts this, that's within their province, and we are legal alone. That's part of it, true?
That's correct.
Okay. And what I'm trying to get at is, in my mind, if I'm a member of the public, and I want to know what the legislature is doing, and I want to see these agreements and see what it is they're adopting or incorporating by reference, is that available to me as a member of the public if I want to voice my opinion on what this says and how it impacts open records?
Certainly. The under 111.92, a public hearing must be held for every tentative agreement. And in this case, there were two public hearings held because the first version was turned down. There were over 100 people who attended these hearings, including, I should note, members of the press. The press was at these hearings. They had every opportunity to get copies of this contract, to look at it, to review it, to raise whatever objections they may have had to the insertion of the word press here. They did not do that.
So these agreements were out there and available for the public to review and voice their objection?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Cobell, was there any notice given to the members of JOKR or to the legislature in regard to the nature of these provisions?
Yes, the procedure followed, Your Honor, is that after a contract has been ratified by the members, OSER, the state entity, submits a copy of each agreement to JOKR. And the way they do it is the new language is there, and all of the new language is underscored, old language is deleted. So it's very clear in the submissions that OSER sent to JOKR that this change was being made because press was put into this language in an underscored fashion. So it was crystal clear to anyone who looked at that language that the parties had negotiated this change and added the word press to the labor agreement.
Let me ask you something else. If we take the approach that I heard you suggesting in regard to conditions of employment, do we ever get to the balancing test here?
No.
What need to do that?
111.93 is a totally separate statute.
Well, assume we do get to the balancing test. What's the harm in releasing this information?
Well, I think that the record contains some pretty graphic examples of the kind of harm that can result from the disclosure of this information. There are examples, and these examples have been undisputed. There are examples of death threats being made to correctional officers over the phone, threats to their families being made. DNR wardens in particular are the subject of some pretty vile forms of harassment, such as putting dead deer carcasses on their on their front doorsteps, for example. Perhaps the most, the most vivid example in the record is the case of a parole officer who had her car firebombed while it was in her driveway. That employee couldn't work anymore. So those are the kinds of dangers this is attempting to avert.
But the balancing test could be applied differently to prison guards than it could be to others, couldn't it?
Well, the language at issue here applies to all state employees who are covered by this particular contract.
But certainly there would be some employees so covered who wouldn't really have any risks different from any other public official. Isn't that fair to say?
Well, I should note that public officials have a special exemption of their own under the Open Records Act prohibiting...
I should have said public employee.
Okay. There may be, you know, a clerical who works in the DNR building, you know, down the street, is in a different situation than a corrections officer. I acknowledge that. But certainly, I mean, the same danger, that clerical employee or that other employee could still do something as part of their job duties that would arouse someone's ire, and then they would be subject to that same kind of potential retaliation.
Counsel, I understand the argument with regard to the statute, 111.93, but the underlying policy arguments that you're making, the policy arguments for safety and security, which are exceedingly important, seem to fall differently if you're a county sheriff rather than the probation agent working across the street. And yet the safety and security concerns are the same.
Well, and the county sheriff, in your example, could conceivably be represented by AFSCME Council 40, and it would be up to that union to try to negotiate protections for that county sheriff, and that county sheriff would also still have the protections of 1936-10A, which prevents everything but their name from being disclosed. So that sheriff is still protected.
Sure, and without this bargaining agreement, the corrections officer, the probation agent, would have the same protections that exist already in Chapter 19. That is, the name can be disclosed, but the personally identifying information as to Social Security, home address, home telephone number, that sort of stuff, may not be disclosed, right?
Yes, I should note, though, that protection in 1936-10 was passed after, several months after, in 2003, after this language at issue here in 244 was ratified. So at the time this was going on, that statutory protection did not exist.
What difference does that make to our analysis?
Well, the difference it makes is that in terms of the balancing test analysis is that what public interests are there in keeping the personal identifying information, including names of employees, confidential, that legislature recognizes, or that 1936-10A recognizes that there is a public interest because that same statute basically copied Article 244. And there's also other provisions of the Open Records Act that specifically address and prohibit disclosure of names. If you're not a finalist as an applicant for a public job, your name can't be disclosed. If you work on a public project as a construction worker, your name can't be disclosed. There are many such examples of specifically addressed to names not being disclosed. That, again, that shows a public policy, a public interest recognition, which happens to be embedded and acknowledged in the Open Records Act, that there is a direct link between disclosure of a name and a potential form of retaliation against public employees. And that's the very strong public interest we're seeking to protect here, and that this particular provision protects. Now, if you look if we're talking about the balancing test, if you look at the countervailing interests that the newspapers are advancing here, I think they fall short. In the case of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, they seek the names of state employees whose privileges to drive state-owned vehicles have been revoked because they, again, in their personal life, have three or more traffic offenses or drunken driving offenses. They have tried to advance reasons why they need the names of those employees to have a discussion about that issue. And in my view, those reasons fall short. What they're saying is that what we need as the press to determine whether those policies for disqualifying drivers are being uniformly applied. Well, on the face, that sounds plausible. But the reality is that if that was the real inquiry here, they would have asked for not just those names of employees who had been disqualified, they'd also ask for the names of those employees who had not been disqualified. They didn't do that here. So they don't even have the information to make this kind of analysis, which they say they need the names for. In the case of the DNR employees, the reasons they cite there is that, well, we need the names in order to determine whether there are ghost employees working at the DNR office in Rhinelander and Woodruff. We need the names to determine whether there's nepotism going on in these offices. Well, in this day and age, one would like to tell you that that's a very remote of a possibility. I acknowledge it is a possibility, but does that possibility outweigh the security needs of those DNR wardens in Woodruff and in Rhinelander not to have their names put out there in public? I submit no.
Well, aren't their names in the public anyway? Aren't there department lists of employees with their names?
Well, certainly that's a reference to these directories that the newspapers attempt to make a big issue about. And the short answer to that, Your Honor, is that the union has filed a grievance protesting those directories. That grievance will be heard by an arbitrator. The arbitrator will decide whether those directories violate the contract or not. And I will note that in the Markey case, that involved a very similar request where inmates in the correctional institution made a request for the names and addresses of correctional officers. The court said no to that, but in the course of that case, one of the arguments that the plaintiffs made was this, the same as it makes here, well, aren't these names for these correctional officers available in telephone directories, names and addresses? The court looked at that and said, that may be true, but that doesn't outweigh the dangers that we're concerned with here to protect the security of these correctional officers. We're not going to allow their security to be jeopardized further simply because their names and addresses might be found in some other directories. So this question of directories, we believe, is a diversionary kind of argument that the court below didn't look at these directories, and we submit neither should this court. In no sense did the existence of these directories constitute a waiver of the union's rights to protect these contract clause in this particular proceeding. All that matters is that the DOA in the Milwaukee Journal case, whether it properly applied this contract provision to redact these names, and whether the DNR in the Lakeland Times case, again, properly applied this contract provision, which it recognized it as a binding provision, to redact the names of the DNR employees in response to that particular request.
Could I ask you a question? A number of years ago, I sat on Joker. Take me back. I hated it, but take me back. Precisely what information would I have had in my hands?
The information you would have had in your hands, Your Honor, is a document prepared by OSIP that would indicate article by article all changes that had been made to the prior agreements. And as I indicated, the changes would be underscored, deletions would have a strike through. So you would have each member of Joker is presented with a full copy of each tentatively ratified collective bargaining agreement to review. And in this particular case, Your Honor, it's clear that the members of Joker looked at this contract because there's record evidence that while it was deliberating over this issue, so someone from OSER made a call to the union and said, would you take out the word press? The union said, no, we're not going to take it out. It stayed in. So Joker knew full well what it was doing when it adopted this agreement.
Counsel, was the collective bargaining agreement ever published?
Well, as part of the bill that ratifies the agreement, there's a requirement that the Department of Employment Relations effectively publish it by presenting a full copy, I believe, to the Secretary of State. So in that sense, it's published. But in that sense...
That's the only sense?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Justice Prosser?
You said someone from the Office of Collective Bargaining called the union and asked about the word press?
Yes.
And that was at a particular time when this matter was before the committee?
Yes.
So you're drawing the... I mean, was there any representation that the Senator so-and-so or Representative so-and-so asked?
No, we're drawing an inference, which I think is a fair inference, that given the timing of the call and the reason for the call, that the reason the call was being made was kind of at the behest of someone in Joker who had some concerns over this issue.
Was this the second round? I mean, didn't this come before the committee at least twice?
I don't think the record indicates the exact date of that inquiry, but it was put before Joker twice over the 3-month period. And so it occurred at some point within that 3-month period prior to Joker's approving the contract and after the contract had been submitted to Joker.
Okay, now when Joker got the contract, did it have any options to change the provisions in the contract, or did they have to accept it all or reject it all?
The statute requires that Joker either accept it or reject it in total. If it rejected it, which it did here, it sent back to the parties, and the parties then must renegotiate it. And certainly, there is a process by which Joker's concerns are communicated to the parties, and the parties can address those concerns as they did here. And then they resubmitted it, and the second time, Joker passed it.
What about once Joker approves it and goes to the legislature?
Yes, after Joker approves it, there is a bill in the form that's been used for at least 20 years, which essentially says the Joker recommends adoption of this committee and the expenditure of all necessary funds. Joker recommends the adoption of this contract and the expenditure of all necessary funds to implement the contract. That's kind of a form that's been used, and then the legislature then passes that bill as it does any other bill.
Does the contract, is that part of the bill? Is the contract part of this bill?
I don't believe that as part, when the bill is made or disseminated, I don't think the contract is attached to the bill. But what the bill says is that the contract must be published with the Secretary of State upon its enactment. But the actual bill itself doesn't accompany, to my knowledge, the bill itself that's disseminated to the full legislature.
So back to my question initially, how would the member of the public get this contract so they could weigh in on what they thought of this as it impacts open records?
Their opportunity is at the Joker hearing, Sean. These are open public hearings. Anyone can come and testify and raise whatever issues they want to raise at these hearings.
The public has this contract. The public has access to that contract so that they could review it before going there so they would know what they're going there for. Or in the legislative process, when there's a bill, would the public have access to that contract?
When OSA transmits the contract to Joker, at that point, any member of the public can request a copy of the contract from Joker to review and then appear at the hearing to raise any issues that they may have with that tentative contract. That's sufficient. If someone has concerns about it, they can get a hold of the contract prior to the hearing, fully review the contract, and raise whatever concerns they may have. And again, the press was at this hearing. The press could have gotten the contract, looked at it, seen the word press in there, and tried to do something about it then. They didn't do it.
would they have done?
They could have raised whatever the same objections they're raising here that they could have raised at that time in front of the Joker. And if Joker and if enough people from Joker agreed with those concerns, they could have vetoed the collective bargaining agreement, sent it back to the parties, and the parties would have understood informally, I assume, what the concern was, and then taken whatever steps were needed to address that concern.
I wonder how a member of the public, though, would be put on notice that a fairly substantive change to the open records law was going to be effectuated through this collective bargaining agreement.
Well, this particular provision had been in the contract with the phrase, notwithstanding the Open Records Act. That had been in the contract since 1995. So there was plenty, you know, and there's plenty of opportunity for anyone in the public to look at that language, and if they had concerns that here's a contract that's making exception to the Open Records Act, is that right or wrong? That those contracts are widely disseminated across the state. Anyone could have seen those contracts and raised whatever issues they had directly with the legislature. Or
well, I think this does kind of clarify that it would need to have been done through the vehicle of a member of the public or whoever actually observing the language within the collective bargaining agreement.
Yes, and again, the prior versions of this had been part of the contract going back to 1985. These exceptions, so it's not something that was concealed from the public in any respect. That there was a provision in this contract that made exceptions to the Open Records Act. I think my time is up.
Thank you, Counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Ron Webbs, Counsel for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
Godfrey & Kahn Law Firm. With me at counsel table is Jennifer Peterson, who ably assisted me on the briefs, but is now media counsel and deputy general counsel for Journal Communications, Inc. Together, we represent the plaintiff respondent newspapers, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and Patrick Miley, who's present this morning, and the Lakeland Times and its publisher, Greg Walker, who's also present this morning. This is, as the court knows, an open records case, not a labor law case, although the two have collided. The state of Wisconsin is justifiably proud of its long tradition of open government. In fact, Wikipedia, the online encyclopedia, credits our state with having the nation's first freedom of information law. This is a reference
to Wikipedia. Journal Sentinel. That's a rhetorical question. Go ahead, Mr. Travis.
The reference is to one of several statutes that required various local offices to be kept open. And in the case that I'm sure generated that encyclopedia reference, County of Jefferson versus Besley, the statute at issue involved the clerk of court, who was required to keep his office open, and all books and papers required to be kept there shall be open for examination of any person. The case came before the court only 8 years after statehood in 1856, and this court ruled that the County of Jefferson had to pay a $22 bill the clerk had incurred for wood and candles to light and heat his office. And the court readily concluded that the purpose of that statute, to open his office to the public for inspection of his papers, would be undermined if it were kept cold and dark. And so heat and light were required. They were an essential part of the statute, and so it was ordered. We're asking the court to bring the same common sense approach today to our current open records law. Because, frankly, the state union's position defies common sense. They are suggesting that a contract provision outweighs a published statute. They get there through the collective bargaining statutes, but most directly through a provision in the open records law that states, except as provided by law, all records shall be open to any person. The except as provided by law part is the linchpin of their argument. They contend that their collective bargaining agreement and all of its provisions related to wages, hours, and conditions of employment have the force of law. And because of 111.93 sub 3, they outweigh the open records law. They get there in two ways. First, they say directly that the Act literally amended the open records law, even though if I examine Chapter 19, I see absolutely no reference to any disability of the press in terms of any person's right to get public records. They get there another way, alternatively, if you don't agree that it has, that it is in fact a law itself, that it is nonetheless a superseding bargaining provision, a contract that's more powerful than law, because it relates to wages, hours, and conditions of employment. We believe that the Circuit Court correctly rejected both arguments. As a matter of statute, and we submit constitutional law, the collective bargaining provision is not a law, because it was not included in a bill. By statute, Section 111.92 sub 1A requires that any proposed amendments contained in a collective bargaining agreement to existing law be included in the bill. And the Circuit Court said because that statute wasn't followed, there was no effective amendment of the open records law. Secondly, the Circuit Court correctly ruled that the state employee's desire for anonymity is not a condition of employment. I think, strictly speaking, the examination on what is a condition of employment should focus on the open records law, because as Section 111.93 sub 3 reads, it's a reference to the other conflicting law that needs to relate to wages, hours, and conditions of employment for the collective bargaining agreement to prevail. And we submit that the open records law cannot be treated as a mere condition of employment for public employees.
The position
of the union in that respect contradicts
Mr.
the...
Mr. Betts, Justice Prosser has a question.
You're relying on 111.92.1A for how to change existing law as a result of a collective bargaining agreement?
That's right, Your Honor.
Okay, I want you to explain to me exactly how that 111.92.1A works.
Well, 111.92 addresses the process for ratifying a state collective bargaining agreement. After both sides reach a tentative agreement, it has to be submitted to JCOER for review. And if the committee approves that tentative agreement, then 111.92 requires that it introduce in a bill or companion bills that portion of the tentative agreement which requires legislative action for implementation, such as salary and wage adjustments, changes in fringe benefits, and any proposed amendments, deletions, or additions to existing law. And it is the union's position that even though this provision wasn't satisfied, the act, the bill that became an act, makes no reference at all to Article 244 or to any intent to amend the open records law.
Let me ask you just a very fundamental question. Let's say there are changes in salary or wage adjustments or fringe benefits. What is the historical evidence of how those things have been ratified in anything other than just the bill approving the collective bargaining agreement?
I think the record evidence is that for at least 20 years, that process was accomplished by the same kind of bill that was used in this case that refers specifically to ratifying the tentative agreement. The act is quoted on page 12 of the appellant's brief. And the language states that the legislature ratifies the tentative agreement negotiated for this biennium, and it directs and authorizes the necessary expenditure of monies for implementation from the appropriations made in section 20.865, etc. So the act that was passed in this case and is a law, a series of them, does specifically authorize the expenditure of funds for the wages and benefits that are provided for in that tentative agreement. What it does not do, and what 111.92.1a says it must do to effect a change, any other change in existing law, is to include those provisions in the bill. So I don't think there's any deficiency in this act in terms of authorizing pay for the covered employees or benefits, but the suggestion that this contract is more powerful than the state's open records law is not in any way supported by the language of the act.
Well, now, your opposing counsel indicates that language to the effect notwithstanding the provisions of 1931 through 1936 has been in collective bargaining agreements. I thought he said 1995. He might have said 1985. If it was 1995, I probably told it. But explain, were there separate bills ever on that?
No, there were not. The reference to the language notwithstanding the provisions of the open records law is to the specific language of Article 244, which is a small part of a 300-page contract. The union's position is essentially that Article 244 and apparently the rest of that 300-page contract are like statutes, and that that has the power of law, not only in its own right, but more powerful than the published Chapter 19 open records law that I consult when I advise my clients on their rights. That provision has never been in an act. It has been in that article of the contract for many years prior to 2003, limited only to excluding disclosure of names, addresses, etc. to rival unions as a union security measure. It apparently was never challenged by the rival unions whether or not that this was in fact sufficient to deny their right under the public records law to ask for names or any other public information. Since it was never challenged, the issue has never come up before today. I don't doubt for a minute that there were public hearings in when the 2003 Act acts were ratified. I don't doubt for a minute that members of the press were present. None of that supports a conclusion that one article in a 300-page contract now has more force than the published statutes of this state with respect to the newspaper's rights under the public records law.
Counsel, if I buy your argument, doesn't the trial court still have to consider an objection by each person who doesn't want their name disclosed and do was Nikki Balance to determine whether or not it should be under the circumstances of that person?
The union was allowed to present a balancing test argument in the circuit court. We opposed that because the legislature had narrowed what had been called Wozniacki rights of a subject of a record to challenge a disclosure of a record about them, had narrowed it to records obtained by subpoena or warrant, records concerning private employees, and disciplinary records of public employees. We don't think names and salaries in the DNR case or names on a list of deactivated drivers in the DOA case qualify under that statute. The circuit court disagreed and said they're an intervener, they're here, they can raise whatever issues they want, and so we heard the balancing test argument. We didn't raise that as an appeal issue because the issues are out there, this court could hear them if it wanted to anyway, and frankly, we think it's an exceedingly weak argument.
So your position is that Wozniacki has been overruled by the statute?
Yes.
And so therefore, what you're requesting simply doesn't fall under the current statutory prescription.
The balancing, what I'm suggesting is that the union does not, under the statute, have a right to notice and an opportunity to challenge disclosure of their names, because unless it's attached to a disciplinary record. Then they do under section 19.356. But a general request for a name attached to a salary would not trigger that Wozniacki right, which the legislature addressed in section 19.356 and narrowed, and also attached procedures to move those cases more quickly through the circuit court.
Mr. Trapp, let me just stop you there for a minute. You answered a question by basically saying that Wozniacki rights were gone based on legislative action. Isn't that a bit of an overstatement? They were narrowed, but I never read what the legislature did as wiping out Wozniacki rights.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to suggest that at all. I thought I had said that they were narrowed by section 19.356.
Well, you answered a question of Justice Rogin's act basically in the manner I just described. And then beforehand, you had said they were narrowed. I just want to clarify what your position is.
My position is that the legislature in section 19.356 narrowed Wozniacki rights. In the case of public employees, they have right to notice and an opportunity to challenge individually before a record about their disciplinary investigation or discipline is released. They do not any longer have a general right to come forward to get notice or to come forward and challenge, under the balancing test, a disclosure of any other record about them subject to the open records law.
But now Judge Faust allowed for the application of a balancing test here, did he not?
Yes, he did.
And you folks won on that, did you not?
Yes, we did.
And on what basis did you argue that the balancing test, if applicable, was not appropriate to foreclose disclosure of this information?
Principally on two grounds. First, the balancing test can never be used to establish a categorical exemption. This Article 244 proposes an exemption for all represented employees, all of their names, no matter whether they're in one of these security classifications like Department of Corrections or parole officers. Anybody represented by this state union would be covered by this. This court has uniformly ruled that the balancing test can only be applied case by case. It's an individual test. You balance the circumstances in the case before you. You cannot use that common law principle to establish a broad categorical exemption like Article 244 does. The second reason is that the names of all of these represented employees are public. The state continues to publish directories. It did not change that practice when these collective bargaining agreements were ratified, beginning in the 2003 biennium. And it hasn't changed that policy since. When we pointed that out in the circuit court, the union disagreed that you could use the online directories without already knowing the employee's name. Their view was that you had to know the name and then you could search for where they work, get a phone number, that sort of thing. We showed, demonstrated in the record, that in fact, anybody without knowing the names by clicking on the right portions of the website could in fact generate a complete list of employees of every state agency, including the Department of Corrections. We went further and approached the Department of Administration, the Department of Corrections, the Department of Natural Resources. A member of the press approached them, Mr. Marlin. He asked them to print out a directory for him, and they did.
Also, I just want to be sure I understand your position, and I want to be sure you understand what was my question. My question was not whether you could categorically exclude on a balancing test the names as a group. My question was if John Doe, who came into court with the initials JD, could have a hearing on his right to keep his name confidential. That was my question to you. And what is your position on that question?
It would depend entirely on what record that name was contained in. If it was contained in a disciplinary record, JD would have the right, or John Doe, would have the right to notice and an opportunity to come forward. But if he does not have that right to notice and an opportunity to challenge under the balancing test under section 19.356, then he would not have that right.
So what you're saying is the statute overruled Wozniacki except for the couple of exceptions that are in the statute. That's your position.
That's right. Section 19.356 was intended to do that. And in this case, the balancing test argument is that this Article 244 created a categorical exemption. It is not an individualized case-by-case determination. It's similar to the Atlas Transit case, in which many years ago the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel sought a list of names of the drivers of school buses in Milwaukee. And in that case, there was a balancing test challenge that predated Section 19.356, and so they had a right to notice and an opportunity to challenge. The union did that on their behalf, and out of a list of hundreds of bus drivers, only a handful were able to justify persuading the circuit court and ultimately the appellate courts that they had sufficient privacy concerns to outweigh the public's presumed right to know their names. And so it is in this case, if there were still a right to notice and an opportunity to challenge, in theory, some portion of the thousands of state employees might be able to justify under the balancing test withholding their names. But nothing in state law gives them the right to collectively bargain for that right and trump the open records law on a categorical basis through a collective bargaining.
So what avenue would you acknowledge for such a challenge, hypothetically on the part of the prison guard, who's trying to keep some of his or her personal information from the inmates that he or she is guarding?
I would recommend that that prison guard work with his union and his legislator to come through the front door of the legislature and argue for a categorical exemption of state employees' names, whether it's limited to correctional employees or all state employees. It's an important policy issue that ought to be debated openly in the legislature, not snuck through the back door in a collective bargaining agreement.
Your position is that if it had been done through open records legislation as an amendment, for instance, then this would be acceptable.
I wouldn't find it acceptable.
Right.
They would have a substantial legal argument.
It would undercut your legal argument today.
It would reduce me to arguing under the state constitution that it's an inherent right of the public to hold public employees accountable, and we would be left with that basis to argue because we would lose any statutory basis to argue.
What about with regard to the group that Justice Gableman talked about, in terms of prison guards, and why can't that be considered a condition of employment superseding under the language of 111.93(3)?
Language in 111.93 states that the provisions of a collective bargaining agreement will supersede other applicable statutes related to wages, fringe benefits, hours, and conditions of employment. So the question isn't whether Article 244 addresses conditions of employment. The question under 111.93(3) is whether it conflicts with an existing statute that is a condition of employment. And it's our position that the circuit court was correct in finding that the public's right to know the names of public employees under the open records law cannot be treated as a condition of employment. We think condition of employment cannot be read so broadly as to encompass anything that contradicts the declared statutory policy of this state, as Section 19.31 does. All persons are entitled to the greatest possible information about the conduct of public officers and public employees. To treat that as an issue open to bargaining between the state and its union when the public isn't even at the table flatly contradicts both that declaration of policy and the state's declaration of policy in the State Employment Relations Act, which recognizes that there are three vital interests at stake in any negotiation: the state, the employees, and the public. The public is the only one who wasn't at the table. And you had the state giving away the public's rights to the union. Well, I'm not at all surprised that the union would like that kind of exemption from public scrutiny and accountability. I'm also not entirely surprised that the state is happy to give it to them. Because, in fact, the purpose of public records access to employee information is almost always not about oversight of the employee, although that's part of it. It's about oversight of those responsible for hiring, firing, and disciplining the public employees. That's the employer. They're at the table. They're saying, sure, you can have that exemption through the collective bargaining agreement. Good luck enforcing it, because they're not here defending it anymore. They did in the circuit court, but haven't appealed. But they gave that away at the bargaining table. Well, what about the public's rights? We weren't at that table. Now, maybe you can argue that we were asleep at the switch and weren't jumping at the gun at the Joker hearing and didn't notice that this provision was in there. Well, that's true. And sure, there may have been hundreds of people in that room. But this exemption isn't in Chapter 19. When I researched whether or not to bring this enforcement action, I couldn't look at Chapter 19 to find out if, in fact, this paper's rights had been somehow eroded. It's not in the statutes. Now, I appreciate that it's always important to avoid constitutional issues if you need to, but they are the elephant in this room. The central issue in this case is, what is a law? The linchpin of the union's argument is, except as provided by law. Is Article 244 a law, or isn't it? I submit it is not.
What was the basis of the decision for the circuit court?
The circuit court relied on the Board of Regents case, which held that Section 111.92.1a is enforceable and must be complied with if a collective bargaining agreement is to supersede the published statutes of the state. Secondly, it also denied their balancing test arguments, as we previously discussed.
Would it be satisfactory to you to just adopt the circuit court decision?
I think Judge Faust got it exactly right, yes. I think finding that that the open records law and the policy of public access, including the press, is not a condition of employment that's open to bargaining. That would certainly be preferable to our narrowest argument, that this was never really intended to address the names alone, because if you ruled on that basis, that would just invite them to go back and try it again. Ruling it outside of the collective bargaining process by saying it is not a condition of employment, so that they can't rely on Section 111.93 sub 3 to say it trumps the existing statutes, is, I think, the next narrowest rationale on which you could affirm the circuit court and would avoid getting into the constitutional issues that were presented. And, you know, as much fun as I had reviewing all of those constitutional things and getting right down into the roots of the law and how it's put together and when it must be published and how it must be published, and even being able to quote Marbury versus Madison, which everyone who's been through law school appreciates, to think that we're here 200 years later debating the same issues is...
Let's talk about that, because that is a good case to talk about. And that comes to mind when I, absent the constitutional argument with regard to Article 4, Section 2, dealing with no law shall be enacted except by bill. Setting that aside, it seems when I started preparing for this case, I looked at 111.92 and 111.93, and I kind of thought to myself, well, I'm not sure this is the best way to do it, but that's the way the legislature chose. They're a separate branch of government. You look at the case of La Follette versus Stitt, and it indicates that if this is the procedure they want to set up, you know, if that's the way they want to do it, which in essence would be that, you know, they're not reading the what's what's really implicated. They're not really, really likely reading the agreement that, or agreements that are subject to the bill before them. That's the way they want to do it. They can do it that way. And I'm not going, under the LaFalla case, be involved in what procedure they set up unless it rubs afoul of the Constitution. Now, we may be proud of Wisconsin being first with regard to public records and open government, and we may consider that law sacred, but it's not constitutional. So why, under Marbury versus Madison, save for your Wisconsin constitutional 4-2 argument, why can't they do it this way without any problem? It's a procedure that they've set up, and in the LaFalla case, there is a separation of powers, and they can do what they want to.
Well, they can do what they want to with respect to their procedure.
Yes.
But 111.92.1a doesn't only include procedure. It also includes the substance of the bill, the content of the bill. It must include any provision intended to change existing law. If it's not in the Act, then under 111.92, it is not superseding existing law. That is respecting the legislature. I think the American Legislative Exchange Council had a very welcome contribution in its amicus brief. They pointed out, contrary to the union's position, which suggests that it would disrespect the legislature not to give effect to Article 244, as they argued for, instead, it's quite the opposite. The legislature is being respected by honoring its published statutes in the open records law, by honoring Section 111.92.1a, which I think plainly is intended to incorporate the requirements of Article 4, Section 17, Sub 2. No law shall be enacted except by bill. Article 244 never appeared in any bill. It is not in the published laws of this state. How am I supposed to advise my clients on their rights if I have to consult not only the statutes, the administrative code, all of the sources of legislative history? This court in Kalal spent a lot of time exploring how you interpret a statute, and nobody, either in the majority, in the principal opinion, or in the concurring opinion, suggested in any sense that a lawyer ought to consult a collective bargaining agreement in advising his clients on their rights under the statutes of this state. So there are a lot of ways to get there, but I think the outcome here should not be in question. The public has a right to know the names of its employees, and the union's effort to undermine that through a collective bargaining agreement must be held unsuccessful.
Mr. Dreps, could I ask, Article 244, this language, notwithstanding the provisions of 19, et cetera, does that sort of provision appear very often in the collective bargaining agreement?
I don't think so. I think it's highly unusual.
Is this unique?
I can't say that. I haven't read a lot of them. But it's the only one I've come across. And it didn't always include that language either, even when it was simply a union security provision. That was added, I think, to beef up that union security provision. But before it added the press, it was never challenged. And I'm sure the rival unions found other ways to communicate with the represented employees. It just lost, perhaps, an easier way to do it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Trapps. Mr. Colbert. Mr. Colbert, if you were going to write this opinion, how would you write it? You obviously would not adopt the circuit court decision.
I would write the opinion reversing the judgment of the court below and dismissing the complaint. I would state, I would base the opinion on Section 111.93.3 entirely. That statute can entirely dispose of this case. However appealing it may be to talk about constitutional law issues, the reality is those issues should be avoided if there's a statutory way of doing it. 111.93.3 does precisely that. Opposing counsel does not seriously dispute that a condition of employment includes the safety concerns addressed here. What he does instead is to try to define conditions of employment and define the inquiry under 111.93 differently by looking at the statute. He indicates that the statute 111.93.3 applies only if the other statute happens to be a labor statute. Well, the two courts that have looked at this have both rejected that. Board of Regents itself looked at this question. It looked at the subject matter of the provision. It found the subject matter of the provision in that case was not a condition of employment. Therefore, that 111.93.3 did not apply. In the DER versus Building Trades case, again, the court there looked at the substance of the provision. It didn't look at the law that happened to house the particular provision. So that's the logical way of interpreting this provision. Even the court below didn't look at that, at the law. It looked at the substance of the provision. We submit that even if the court looks at the substance of the open records law and asks, is this a labor law in some respect, it certainly is. This court's recent jurisprudence over the many recent years has dealt extensively with the conditions under which personnel records can be released. That is a labor issue. There are numerous exemptions and much language in the open records law addressing what can be called employment issues, namely the conditions that personnel records can be released. So even under that definition, which we submit is a wrong definition, 111.93.3 does apply here.
244, is that, are there other provisions like that in collective bargaining agreement?
There are no other provisions which expressly state notwithstanding a certain law. However, it is commonplace for parties to bargain additions to or modifications to state law through collective bargaining. In this particular agreement, the parties have, in essence, amended the State Family Medical Leave Act by increasing the types of categories of employees who can take personal leave. The parties have also, in essence, changed Section 230.36, which provides disability pay to employees who have been hurt on a job, by adding classifications in addition to those set forth in the statute as being qualified. Now, those two provisions also change state law. They weren't put in a separate piece of legislation. And the bottom line is, if this court adopts this kind of provision, what it's doing is it's casting doubt on the validity of the 25 collective bargaining agreements that the legislature adopts and has adopted under this procedure for the last 20 years. Anyone could come along and say, well, this provision wasn't passed properly through a separate law, therefore this contract is unlawful. In addition, the other problem created by the court below's decision is what happens in the future. What the court said, it adopted what Board of Regents said, we have to have a literal interpretation of 111.92. Well, a literal interpretation of 111.92 would look like this. You would have to have a separate legislation, not only for changes in laws, but also for wages and changes to fringe benefits, because that's what is provided. So you would have to have a separate law.
Isn't there a difference between casting doubt on the validity of a fully negotiated and bargained for union contract in regard to its provisions and determining that that contract in one respect does not change an existing law because it didn't follow the procedures to change the law? You don't need to follow the procedures to change the law if you're just determining what the rate of pay might be, if you're determining you're going to give more rights to a worker than what the statute provides. It's not really changing the law. Here, what you're telling us is that the open records law has been changed because of the contract. Somehow I see that a little bit different than being concerned about whether the contract is valid. I don't think anybody said the contract isn't valid. I think the argument is that it didn't follow the procedures to make a change in the law, so it would affect other people's rights other than those that bargained for the provisions of the contract.
Well, the distinction as to wages and fringe benefits versus change in the law, again, that the court below adopted what it called a literal interpretation of 111.92. And if you're going to do it literally, then you have to do it not only for changes of law, but for wages and benefits as well. But you know, going back to your point about whether the law is valid, and again, this is only on the question of is it an exception to the open record?
Right, exactly.
The fact remains is that what the court below said is that this is a very important law that for the people of Wisconsin, and therefore it should have been put as a separate piece of legislation. Now, I mean, let's look at that. What that really is saying is that had it been a separate piece of legislation, in the judge's opinion below, there's no way the legislature would have passed this law. So that is a classic form of second-guessing legislative analysis. 111.92 says that it's the exclusive province of the legislature to decide what parts of that bill sent to Joker have to get put in and passed as a separate bill. That is a purely legislative decision that is not
been second guessed. They have to exercise it in a constitutional fashion.
That's correct. My time is up. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Cobalt. Thank you, Mr. Reps, for your argument today on yet another Freedom of Information decision. That concludes our hearing on 07-AP-1160, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel versus DOA et al. The students should remain here, as well as anyone else who wishes to participate in the discussion. With Justice Crooks and other students will join them. The court will reconvene at 1:30 for its third oral argument.